If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. In the latest issue of the magazine, we've included a piece on war trauma, exploring how it's developed and been understood from the French Revolution until today. The piece was written by Emma Butcher of the University of Leicester and Hannah Partis Jennings from Loughborough University. A little while back, they explored the topic further in a conversation with our digital editorial assistant, Rachel Dinning.
So we've been aware of the psychological impact of war on individuals for thousands of years. Emma, perhaps you can tell us some of the earliest mentions of war trauma that we've come across.
So the earliest mentions usually go back to ancient times and ancient documents. So, for example, in the Iliad, there's an instance with Achilles, the soldier, suffering nightmares and fears of isolation and survival guilt after his friend dies in battle. So this is a very early example. And this kind of spills over generally into more kind of ancient stories. So, for example, there's a soldier called Epizelus in the Battle of Marathon, which was fought in about 490 BC. And there's this really interesting account of him just going blind in the middle of battle. So spontaneous blindness, it's called. So again, another kind of symptom. And I mean, me and Hannah were having this discussion earlier. It's an interesting discussion. But another instance is in ancient Mesopotamia. So this is Iraq about 3,000 years ago. And I think it's really interesting with what we both research on in the fact that obviously the recent wars in Iraq, there's been a lot of focus on PTSD and soldiers returning. But Iraq, 3,000 years ago, you've got the King of Elam saying that his mind had changed after experiencing so many years of constant battle. So you have these kind of small instances that you can pick out from documents, but there's again a lack of labelling, a lack of medical understanding in trauma. But like I said, this goes all the way back to kind of BC times.
Because this is one of the things, like PTSD is quite a recent, as an actual label, it's a very recent thing, but you're saying that there's evidence of the symptoms of this going as far back as then?
Absolutely. So there's an absence of definition, there's an absence of labelling. And this is what my research, I'm generally interested in. I mean, these are kind of examples I've said about ancient times going through into the Middle Ages. You've got examples in the Crusades of soldiers whose a chronicler describes how their hearts were pierced by swords of sorrows from different sorts of suffering. So you have these kind of little examples in chronicles, but then moving forward into what we see as more modern warfare. So I specialise in the Napoleonic Wars. So these began around 1800 to 1815. And these were wars fought between primarily Britain and France with Napoleon as emperor. And this is the first time in the kind of beginnings of modern warfare that you see a focus on individual suffering and individual soldiers experiencing, these symptoms that have run throughout history, but there's no label. It's only really in recent years that we've given this kind of malady a name, effectively.
So is this a bit of a turning point?
The Napoleonic Wars were a turning point in the sense that the dawn of Romanticism happened in the 18th century, where for the first time, the arts, culture and individuals were focused on individual suffering, individual feeling. And there was this somewhat turning point between seeing battles and armies as groups of people en masse. And there was a real kind of sense of recognizing that in the middle of this cog in the war machine, that each individual cog were experiencing their own experiences, their own feelings and their own relationship with war. So we had lots of artists and writers of the period focusing on the individual soldier. And then during the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, you had about 200 soldiers who wrote down their experiences of war. And this became known as a genre called the military memoir. And these were soldiers writing down their feelings. And within this kind of genre, this movement of battle writing, you had soldiers grappling with their own experiences of trauma for the first time. But again, these were very much a kind of personal reflection and not seen in any kind of medical way. It was them saying how they suffer melancholia or nostalgia or nightmares or these kind of symptoms, again, of trauma, but not saying I'm suffering from trauma.
So at what point in history did we begin to see a shift from looking at it from that perspective and looking at it from an actual medical perspective?
So one of the reasons why I'm interested in war trauma is that it acts as a kind of locus for wider perceptions and attitudes in society, in politics, in culture. And there are these kind of consistent themes that thread through it around our understanding of combat and its meaning, our understanding of the soldier as an entity, our understanding of different wars that kind of manifest culturally, politically, and socially through this category of war trauma. So you can see these things coming up. And one of the themes is this notion of kind of medicalization, where how the medical profession engages. So yes, in 1915, off the back of the large scale of cases of what became known as shell shock, about 80,000 cases coming out of the First World War, though it's hard to give an exact figure because of the way that the diagnostics were managed. But Charles Myers comes up with this term shell shock, and it is influenced by the symptoms that manifested amongst passengers who had been through a railway crash. So it's tied in medical discourse initially very much to the idea of brain trauma, so kind of a somatic cause, you know, a bodily aspect.
A physical thing.
A physical thing, yes. But it gradually becomes kind of more broadly understood as a psychosomatic and a psychological malady. And again, you can see this in the way that the medical discourse shapes our understanding of shell shock around the First World War. So you have key figures like William Rivers, Craig Lockhart, the famous trauma hospital or recovery hospital in Scotland. And the way he deals with the idea of shell shock is very influenced by Freud. So it's very much about locating a point of trauma in the person's story and getting them to kind of re-engage with that story to undo the repression of that memory that they have engaged with.
So in these hospitals that came about just after the war, these were the kinds of therapies that soldiers were experiencing?
So this is an interesting question. I think medical discourses and medical treatments were, as I said, kind of informed by wider social dynamics like class and gender. Straight away, there's this, initially, the idea of hysteria is very much, and Freud's treatment of hysteria is very much understood as a female malady. So when male soldiers, and of course, soldiering is understood then and to some extent throughout history as this kind of pinnacle of masculinity. So when soldiers start to manifest these symptoms of hysteria and it becomes labeled within the remit of shell shock as a kind of male hysteria, that's quite unsettling. So there's an attempt to try to navigate that, to try to produce a wider rationale that can fit with the understanding of the soldier as this kind of masculine hero. But it also means that symptoms of shell shock are often discredited at this point. So they're seen to be degenerate, to be faking it, they're malingering, they're trying to get out of the war. And you can see this actually operating quite a lot along class lines. So the tendency is to forgive these symptoms much more so in the officer classes and to recognize these symptoms of nervous breakdown and to provide these treatments like at Craig Lockhart, which operate through talk therapy, and recognition of repressed trauma, whereas somebody like Lewis Yelland at the National Hospital treated lower class, it manifested along the lines of rank, but these tended to map onto class during the First World War. So treated lower ranking privates with this kind of very physical, arguably quite violent approach. So with electrocution therapy, it's been recorded in his narratives of his treatments, even burning patients with cigarettes. So the level of sympathy and the way that trauma was treated at this time, it definitely entered into the medical mindset, into the medical narrative. So it became labeled, as Emma was saying, but it was treated and understood differently depending on kind of who you were.
And it's interesting that that's when the treatment began and it was so brutal, because if you go back through the 19th century, it's open to this bewildering array of labels by medical professionals, so by surgeons.
What sort of labels did we have for over the years?
In the Napoleonic Wars, it was called cannonball wind, and it was seen that just soldiers would take fright from a passing cannon, so the cannon fire. And then you've also got, during the American Civil War, it was often called something called soldier's heart. And that was when it was seen that knapsacks were too tight on soldiers' chests, so the strings would push onto their chest and cause discomfort. But again, these are all very physical symptoms of a mental malady. And then even when we think about surgeons kind of thought about any kind of psychological causes for this. So, for example, they'd call it nostalgia. And this comes from the Greek term for nostos, meaning home, and algos, meaning pain or ache. So the desire to return home. So very kind of superficial labelling, and again, very, very physical. And treatment up until the First World War, soldiers were locked in lunatic asylums, but just left there. You know, there are a lot of the diaries and reports of soldiers, especially soldiers from the American Civil War, returning home. A lot were farmers and labourers. So they were, again, trying to reintegrate and just return to normal life, to their old kind of civilian way of life. And you have instances of them becoming increasingly more violent. There was a case of a man called Neil Story, who eventually became so violent that his family just isolated him in a log cabin for many years before giving him over to a lunatic asylum. And that's just where he died later on. So it's very much soldiers just coming home to not be treated and to die eventually, just kind of left completely unsupported by society.
I mean, you mentioned that there was a rise after the Napoleonic Wars in the military memoir. Today we talk about having like a taboo about mental health, but people did talk about their feelings in these memoirs. Do you think there was a taboo at this time or not?
I think that the memoirs were kind of seen as melodrama by a lot of the reading public, because beforehand, an everyday civilian would have no understanding of what war was like. So when you present this very new genre of writing, which armchair readers can just read amongst their families, they're able to vicariously experience a war which they would have never often found out about, basically, apart from hearsay. So a lot of these soldiers, when they were coming back and writing these memoirs, they were also doing it for money as well, because as soon as a soldier returned, they were put on half pay, which was not really enough to sustain themselves and their families. So writing these books, they're not just talking about their feelings, but they're trying to exaggerate. They're trying to be dramatic at the same time. So it's difficult sometimes separating the truth of their experiences for kind of the exaggerated hyperbolic version of that truth. Again, it's an exciting thing for maybe the public that don't see the broader issues. One family that I do research in particular is the Bronte family. And the Brontes are known for the later writings of Jane Eyre, Wuthering Heights. But as children, they were reading these military memoirs and creating a fantasy world based on these military memoirs. And within their fantasy world, they were creating soldier characters that were experiencing symptoms of war trauma. So even though there was no kind of medical terminology, you can see that the feelings and experiences of soldiers were rippling through the cultural fabric of the landscape and right into kind of the homes. And I know that they're just one case study, but you have these fantasy soldiers in their world experiencing nightmares and hallucinations and seeing blood pouring out from under the bed. And also kind of, it's very Freudian, obviously it's pre-Freudian, but also soldiers returning to the battlefield in their mind and going over and over things that can't be undone. So it's quite interesting seeing, maybe that's just a, they were children when they were writing these. So children have these kind of intuitive, very raw responses to things. So it might be just a kind of way, a child's reaction to this. But certainly the public were picking up on this, but a majority were using it for entertainment value.
Mm-hmm. So we know that war trauma, as you mentioned, it didn't just affect the soldiers themselves directly. It seeped back into society. What was the psychological impact of war on, you know, the wider families when the soldiers returned? What examples do we have from, do you have any case studies like the Bronte family?
It's interesting because even though I work on the Brontes and their reactions to war, there's no evidence that they ever spoke to any returning soldiers in, so the Brontes live in Haworth in North Yorkshire. And even though they didn't, we don't have any records that they spoke to soldiers. Certainly a lot of the soldiers that returned to the local area were instrumental in the Luddite rebellions of the early 19th century, where local workers protested about the industrialisation of machinery. And also later the Chartist movement as well, trying to change and enact political reform. So you have a kind of wider landscape of soldiers becoming very violent and very politically active, which the Brontes would have understood. But again, it's very much just in the kind of the local landscape. In terms of the impact on families, certainly artists of the period were really interested, starting to become very interested in widows and children, and painting and sketching images of the kind of mournful widow left alone with her child. So there's a plate printed by William Dickinson called Affliction, which shows a dead soldier, a lone dead soldier on the floor with his wife kind of holding his child, just crying over his body. So there was a general understanding of the impact of losing such a huge amount of the male population. In Waterloo alone, you know, 15,000 dead. In the American Civil War, over 750,000 dead. So that's obviously going to have an impact on the wives and children that are left behind. But that's just the 19th century. So I think probably more in the 20th century.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. So certainly within the immediate family, and this is something that is reflected in contemporary times, there are implications around violence, domestic violence, the instability of a person who is suffering from PTSD relating to war experiences and war trauma, kind of wider issues like depression, suicide, alcoholism that plague veterans suffering from trauma in different ways. It definitely has also entered into the kind of cultural landscape, as Emma has mentioned, this idea of figures, traumatized figures. You know, this comes up in Virginia Woolf and Mrs. Dalloway. The idea of the soldier in the contemporary times. And I, you know, I've done interviews with soldiers who fought in Afghanistan in the modern day, and they in some ways make reference to their own experiences via figures like Owen and Sassoon. So certainly there's this sense that, and you know, both Owen and Sassoon write about this idea of war trauma as central to their experience in different ways. But there's also the issue, which I think is important, of the extent to which there was a disconnect in many instances between soldiers returning back and the wider population who just simply couldn't properly recognize, or they felt couldn't properly engage with what they had been through. And that this then in turn, so this is something that comes up in relation to the Vietnam War, and there's this Winter Soldier investigation, which is a 3-day period in Detroit in 1971, where just over 100 veterans get together. And it's organized by the entity Vietnam Veterans Against the War. So it does have this kind of explicit underlying political rationale. And the idea behind this is that these veterans will have the opportunity to give testimony, to talk about what they had done in the context of the Vietnam War and how they felt, the kind of lasting trauma that they were experiencing, bearing in mind that the war was ongoing and that within the American media there was starting to be conversations about the kind of morality of the war and atrocities that were taking place there. But one of the interesting things that you see reflected in this testimony is that when, and this is very much demonstrated by the testimony of Robert Lifton, who's a psychiatrist at Yale and a Vietnam veteran, and he comes to this Winter Soldier investigation and he gives testimony, and he suggests that one of the reasons why veterans struggle so much to readjust after Vietnam is this dissonance between their experiences and their civilian life, their experiences at war and their civilian life. And this often manifests in terms of an inability to make sense of their role as veterans. Because in the broader political landscape in America, there is this increasing distaste for what's going on in Vietnam. And this influences the idea of moral injury. And moral injury is a kind of whole spectrum of ways of thinking about war trauma, which center on the notion that you have, by participating in war in general or a particular war act, somehow fractured your own morality. So somehow come up against your own ideas of right and wrong, and that you're struggling to reconcile that. You're struggling to make sense of that. So that's the idea of moral injury kind of sits within wider conceptions of war trauma. And it is also linked to this notion of the broader society's inability to understand you, to not get treated as a hero, perhaps, to get,
that's
in fact,
true, and
rejected.
Push that image of the soldier as the hero. And that's
exactly
been a consistent thing throughout history. And then how you reconcile that with when you come home and the actual reality of being back in your normal environment.
Exactly.
I think it's also, I think it's really interesting thinking about war trauma and how what actually war trauma means as centuries change as well, because we're kind of calling it this blanket term, war trauma. But certainly in terms of the kind of 18th, 19th century and before, how battles were fought was very concentrated. People were in very close proximity to one another. It was kind of muskets and cannon fire, and you can see the person that you're killing. You're very much confronted by that. And then during the American Civil War, advances in riflery and cannon fire meant they were more powerful. So you're seeing your neighbours and your friends kind of blown up in front of you, and you're kind of physically covered in them. And that's incredibly traumatic. And then warfare changes, doesn't it? Because you get to the First World War.
Drone pilots even today, and they still experience, I think, they still experience things like PTSD, even though they're not as immediately there on the ground.
Yeah, so as Emma says, it kind of brings to the fore this relationship between distance and proximity when it comes the role of combat. Increasingly, medical practitioners and scholars of war are aware that actually combat is not necessary for people to experience war trauma. They don't have to have faced combat. Whereas, again, as Emma is saying, and this is evident in Sassoon and Owen's poetry as well, there is this real viscerality to the experience of soldiering, froth, corrupted lungs, as articulated by Wilfred Owen, that there is this immediacy, even with the technological advancements of the First World War, there is this immediacy to killing. This comes out also in the Winter Soldier investigation in relation to Vietnam. But by the time you get to the contemporary context, this notion of remoteness that's, I suppose, epitomized by the drone pilot and the controversy surrounding whether or not drone pilots actually should be understood as soldiers in the traditional sense, participating in combat in the traditional sense. And yet what we know, what we see is that they are experiencing war trauma and they are definitely experiencing a different kind of intimacy in relation to the acts that they participate in, the acts of violence, and the moral choices that get made around this. And it's really, really well represented in George Brandt's play, Grounded, which is a one-woman play. Anne Hathaway actually performed the central character at one point. And he, through the way that the play is written, kind of articulates this collapse between the home front and the battlefront that takes place for the central character, who is a drone pilot. So even if she is not, and in the end, she experiences war trauma, an inability to distinguish between the battle spaces that she's watching 18 inches away from her face on a screen and her own life. In the US, those two things collapse together. So almost in a way, the kind of opposite to what Emma is saying, where there's this very visceral and intimate relationship to killing throughout history, kind of point blank range, as it were. And then in the context of the contemporary era, this almost opposite relationship to the acts of violence that are engaged with in war, but still manifesting as a particular kind of war trauma. And this speaks to Emma's point about the diversity, the need
it's
to kind of particularize.
Term,
exactly.
Yeah.
And also not just as well, you've got the kind of soldiers in the midst of it, but you've got the repercussions on the family and the home and the fear of war entering into the domestic front. So there's the caricature that James Gilray drew of the soldier returning home who's physically mutilated by war, and the family terrified of this kind of new soldier and this new head of the family that's returned to them, and this kind of fear of a generational impact. Mm-hmm. And in the American Civil War as well, you had cases of trauma kind of reverberating through generations of family. You know, move on to
having
the second
a bit of a legacy.
Exactly.
Carries on down the generations.
I mean, I think that in the Second World War as well, there's certainly been that kind of generational legacy and the people suffering, and I've read reports and accounts of children suffering trauma from the incessant kind of bombing, especially of areas like Hull, who were just bombed so, Hull and London sort of bombed incessantly, and the fear of war becoming then part of the home as well, which I guess links into what Hannah's saying about drone pilots as well, that they bridge that soldier-civilian divide where there's soldiers during the day, then they come home at night to their families and have dinner. And that's the first time, isn't it, that really you're able to do that. And every day you're kind of switching between roles. It's
absolutely this kind of famous line that somebody can be engaged in war for 12 hours, leave the theatre and be asked to pick up milk on the way home. So this total collapse between those spaces, as Emma's saying.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
I think that trauma, as well as it affecting different people in different ways, it's evolved and changed as the centuries have passed. So I'm reluctant to go back and say, you know, this particular soldier was experiencing this. It's just that the symptoms match up our modern day descriptions.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
When we think of war trauma, that phrase, it would be a myth to just immediately think war trauma, it means PTSD. It means someone who's been out there and, you know, they've seen something absolutely horrific and come home. It's not just that, it's a much broader, wider thing affecting society. I was going to say, it takes such a long time for war trauma to be established as a medical condition, and we've talked about this a bit already. What were some of the key turning points in history for how we approach and manage trauma? What do you think was the most significant?
So I think the First World War, for me, was probably the most significant moment in terms of how and the extent, not just because the First World War, I think, functions very specifically. And we're looking here, and this is an important caveat, at the Anglo-American context, and in this case, very much the British context with the First World War. So this doesn't resonate globally, and individual nations have their own legacies and stories when it comes to their histories of war and war trauma. But in terms of the British context, I think the sheer scale of the individuals who were suffering, the techniques that had to be developed to manage this, you know, even to the point of bringing forward these war trauma managing hubs to the front, because there was this fear that if you bring people back, they will get a taste of home and they won't want to return to warfare. And bearing in mind, of course, that this is ultimately always the goal in relation to First World War treatment is, if possible, to return somebody to the front. And this, I think, is key. You know, it's about being able to correct what has, in this frame of reference, kind of gone wrong so that soldiers can return to the front. So there's not so much. It's very interesting looking at Siegfried Sassoon's story, you know, this famous war poet. And he was diagnosed with shell shock because he objected morally to what was going on in the First World War. So even the kind of idea that moral objection is kind of pathologized. I think that that was at the heart of some of the ways that it was treated. But as I said, even though, so there was certainly things that would be extraordinary to us in terms of how mental health was approached in the First World War. I think it was a turning point in terms of it very much entered into the kind of social and political frame of reference and had to be dealt with. So you get psychologists and psychiatrists asked to be involved in kind of pre-deployment training by the Second World War. So there's this understanding that resilience is a facet of soldiering, that it is a traumatic experience. And I think that this does stem, and you can see this to today. As I said with the drone pilots, there was a lack of expectation that drone piloting as a form of soldiering would be productive of PTSD, of war trauma in the same way. But there is a much faster learning process in the contemporary context, this kind of rapid recognition that these are the symptoms. They may not be attributed to specific things. So there's a general reticence, I think, to allocate specific causes because, as we said, of the kind of diversity of reasonings behind why somebody might experience war trauma. And the importance in the contemporary time, attention has been drawn to the importance of not centering combat. Mm. And this impacts female soldiers as well. As we know, female soldiers...
I was going to ask, actually, is there a gender difference in how war trauma is, how we look at war trauma?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think this centering of combat experience has had implications for female soldiers whose condition as might not be recognized as PTSD, as war trauma in the same way if they didn't serve in a combat role. And we know in Britain and America, this has only become legally and technically possible in the last few years. So the female engagement teams in Afghanistan, for example, weren't technically frontline soldiers, even though they were exposed. So just to clarify, the female engagement teams are all female units that operated in Afghanistan in the context of the recent war that were deployed alongside more traditional units, and they had a specifically counterinsurgency mandate. So they were specifically tasked with engaging with the Afghan population. But because of the nature of the Afghan war, because of the nature of the war in Afghanistan and counterinsurgency warfare, these individuals were exposed to combat. So the distinction was more of a technical one. They were under fire, they were in danger, there were improvised explosive devices in the terrains where they worked. So the gendered dynamics can manifest in terms of how people are understood as soldiers. And if combat is central to that, then there might be this kind of, oh, well, if you're not a combat soldier, then how can you experience PTSD in the same way? And again, I think there's been some learning around that. Similarly, with the prevalence of sexual violence and harassment in the context of the military and how that can compound trauma. And again, this is, you know, potentially providing a different lens. Back to what Emma was saying, this catch-all phrase, we still need to disaggregate a little bit on in terms of kind of the logics and the particularities of that for individuals, dependent on their context, dependent on things like gender and sexuality. There's been high instances of psychological symptoms in transgender soldiers who suffer additional layers of discrimination and potentially violence within the military context. So all of that, I think, plays a role, as Emma was saying.
It's still progress as well, because generally mental illness is its recognition, its treatment by society and by medical practitioners is still ongoing, isn't it? There's still, like you said, war trauma is multifaceted, but also it's combined, isn't it? It's not just how we talk about mental illness. It's how we talk about LGBTQ plus rights. It's how we as a society begin to accept that it's not just a basic formula for treatment. There's, as history has taught us as well, trauma is experienced in a multitude of ways. It's difficult going back into history and labelling soldiers and saying, oh, well, they experienced PTSD.
Oh, retrospectively
because
diagnosing.
This is not, yeah. I think that trauma, as well as it affecting different people in different ways, it's evolved and changed as the centuries have passed. So I'm reluctant to go back and say, you know, this particular soldier was experiencing this. It's just that the symptoms kind of match up our modern day descriptions, but it doesn't mean that even those symptoms are the same symptoms. But that's, again, relative with weaponry, to progress in rights, to all of these different societal factors and political factors that also filter into these kind of mental states.
Mm-hmm. So I suppose just to sort of wrap up, where do you think we are today and where do you think we need to be in our attitude to war trauma?
So I think one caveat, academics love caveats. I sometimes make so many caveats that I can't remember what my original point was. But one caveat that I think is important, so one of the elements of my research is also looking at one of the ways I've encountered war trauma is amongst war-affected civilian populations in Sri Lanka, for example. So I think one caveat, one important facet of consideration is that, yes, it is crucial to consider the experiences of veterans and soldiers, but it's also very vital, and this was something that came up in my interviews with soldiers as well, who recognize the symptoms of war trauma in civilian populations living in Afghanistan. So this idea of paying attention to war trauma as something that is experienced by multiple populations, I think that's crucial. Yeah. And some of the insights that we've generated through the various experiences of soldiers, for example, in Britain and America, next steps, I think, thinking about how that impacts civilians who might not have access to the diagnostic tools that soldiers, for example, do. But also, I think, considering modes of expression, and this is something that comes out in what Emma and I have been so interested in, is the kind of consistent engagement via cultural outlets with trauma, even when it didn't have a name, even when it in some ways wasn't possible to express in other domains of life. Poetry, art gave a potential language and a voice to what people had been through, what people had experienced. So I think there's something there in terms of going forward and something that is capitalized on in some instances, you know, looking at the potential of other spheres, cultural spheres, for instance, to provide a different vision of war that might offer an opportunity for those who've encountered war trauma to express themselves through a different means. And that comes up, I think, in our work.
And I think as well, I think the global reach is really important as well in terms of going back to the past. I mean, Hannah's rightfully said that these are very much British and American perspectives of the past as well. And that's usually because that's the records that are available. You know, these things that survive. So I think for me, it is trying to find the past and see how they experienced war from the other side of things. I've got a very kind of British Empire perspective here, which I would like to dismantle and like to see the other sides of war and of civilian impact, and also thinking about things written in concentration camps. You know, one thing that I'm really interested in at the moment is the Boer War, the Second Boer War in the late 19th century. And, you know, multiple Boers were put in concentration camps and their records survive. But they are all in Afrikaans and Dutch, so it's very difficult to access those without language as well, which sadly I don't have, so I admit. So it would be trying to get more people interested in kind of the multifaceted voices from the past, which academics need to really bring to light and bring to the fore.
That was Emma Butcher and Hannah Partis-Jennings. You can read that article in the September issue of BBC History magazine, which is available now. The issue also has pieces on a range of other historical topics, including the Princes in the Tower, the real Peaky Blinders, and the outbreak of the Second World War. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back on Monday, when I'll be speaking to Brendan Sims about Hitler's worldview.